You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy Inauguration Week.
Inauguration Week, end of a national nightmare week, and we'll not even really the end. This is just...
Hopefully,
but, you know, I'm not super certain about that. I think we're far enough down this road at this point where it doesn't really matter who's the judge, but I won't go too far down the politics rabbit hole today.
At least Syracuse played well. Never mind.
Yep. Well, the Syracuse women's team played well.
That's true, yes.
They blew out Miami.
Dominated Miami. Enjoyed that.
Yeah, really fun game for them. Yeah, a ton of points. Really great for them to be back on the court for the first time in 28 days. In general, they're the only bright spot for Syracuse sports at the moment, and hopefully that changes soon once the men's and women's lacrosse teams are back in action. We don't have any dates on that just yet, but again, hopefully soon. Dan, a couple of news items before we get into some football talk, and then we'll have a bunch of men's basketball talk in the back end. Of this episode for those interested. Doug Marrone seems to be the favorite. According to Cole Kubelik, it seems that he's the favorite to land the offensive line coach job at Alabama, one of those patented Nick Saban kind of, you know, year sabbatical gigs. That sounds pretty good. I'd honestly be shocked that Doug would want to be back in the college ranks. But at the same time, he's probably going to get paid what he got paid as a head coach at Syracuse. I'd say that he's a lot more to work with than he probably did even with the Jaguars in terms of talent. And realistically, like if he leaves after a year, Nick Saban's not going to hold it against him because he's used to it.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of just how the Saban experience works at this point. He takes on like recently, I mean, a lot of people, you know, generally a lot more baggage than Marrone. I think Marrone stripped down a number of jobs after losing the Jaguars head coaching job. And honestly, like all things considered, I think he could end up being a head coach at the NFL level. But like, this whole Saban thing, he's like really relaunched people and, you know, guys like Lane Kiffin and now Steve Sarkisian has one of the biggest jobs in college football after a couple of years with Saban. And I mean, Butch Jones got a new head coaching job after being an analyst for Saban for a year. His running backs coach wasn't obviously in quite the same like rehabilitation thing, but got the Marshall job. So like it's a very fruitful opportunity to go under Saban for a year or two and really like kind of it just seems to add to your resume in this huge way where you kind of reestablish yourself as like both like a hireable coach, which obviously I don't think was Marone's issue. And then also like you get this like kind of air of learning under Saban in terms of program management that seems to go a long way forward. Now, we haven't seen people use it really to springboard themselves into the NFL, but and like from what we've heard about Marone in the post SU days, like it doesn't sound like he wants to be back with the college level. Maybe he's changed his mind. Maybe he's evolved on that. It seems like a good opportunity though. And I think like he definitely wasn't a guy who couldn't have gotten jobs elsewhere. So I think he seems to have like a pretty specific view on how he wants to push things forward. So good luck to him there. He'll have plenty of talent to work with because Alabama's offensive line is always just absolutely loaded.
Yeah. I mean, realistically, you get like the NFL environment without the NFL like rigor in many ways. Because realistically, like the team's going to win 10 plus games next year. That's obvious. So you have an expectation, but acknowledge that you're going to meet said expectation. And really, like, you know, Doug will obviously have some things he'll need to do as offensive line coach, but there's so much talent on that roster year in and year out that, you know, a couple missteps by Doug is not going to tank the entire team. And admittedly, like while I was a Doug believer for a long time, especially when he seemed to turn the Jags around almost immediately when he first got there, things kind of fell apart in recent years, in part talent, in part just like roster management, just a institutional failure by the Jags. And that's why I'm so curious about what Urban Meyer can do there. But with Marone, I just think there's just something that he's got to fix. And like you were kind of talking about, like it might just be a quick year, you know, put that Jags memory behind him and everybody else and jump right back into the you know, NFL ranks, even if it's just not as an offensive coordinator. But I think this is a good move for him. And assuming, of course, he gets the job.
Yeah, I mean, there's no real arguing against it. Like it's springboarded, like, I mean, there's so many coaches who have launched into pretty major head coaching jobs in the years after working for Saban. I mean, out of the offensive line position, Mario Cristobal was there a couple of years ago, and now he's the head coach at Oregon. Kyle Flood, you know, kind of did a similar thing. He was in the NFL for a minute and then popped over to Alabama for a year or two under Sark and Saban, and now he's the OC at Texas under Sark. So, like, yeah, there's a lot of interesting directions he can go here, but if nothing else, I think it'll be pretty cool to have Marone back in the college game and like where we can follow him really directly. Not that we couldn't follow him with the Jaguars, but the Jags of the last couple of years were kind of a sad experience, especially after that 2017 season where they were like very, very close to making the Super Bowl.
I'd argue Alabama gets more exposure than the Jags do.
That's certainly possible. I mean, it's definitely like, I think it's hard to say that even like the NFL college gap, which is what it is, but it's not like super significant. I think college football is probably like the second most popular sport in this country, honestly, yeah. If not, or third, maybe, behind the NFL. So, and Alabama is obviously the king of one. Jacksonville is probably the like bottom of the other. So I think Alabama is the bigger stage, but, it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say too about, I know Saban assistants don't talk to the media very much, and that's probably certainly fine with Doug. But I would like to hear more about like where he saw things falling apart, because I definitely don't think it was all him. I think like Coughlin clearly didn't have like the greatest reins on keeping that roster up. And then you have the Jalen Ramsey stuff, which was tough, and other key players wanting to get out of that environment. So, you know, it seemed like people liked Doug well enough. It seemed like some things like around him kind of fell apart and he couldn't stop the bleeding for the most part.
Yeah, I think that's all pretty reasonable. Also, before we get to some more specific Syracuse-related stuff, Dan, looks like the Mets are making moves, and I'm really liking the aggressiveness from this front office. This is uncharted territory for us as fans. Big, big fan of what's going on, and I really hope that that George Springer is going to be on the Mets by the end of this week.
I mean, he's been kind of rumored for a while now, and then, you know, there was some thought that maybe the Lindor trade, I think that was last week. I don't know what time or space is anymore. But it's, I think that was last week, was obviously just giant, but some people thought that might kind of preclude them from going after Springer. But based on Steve Cohen's ever interesting Twitter presence, it doesn't seem like that's the case. He's hinted enough at it still being in the air, and it's down to basically us and the Blue Jays. And, you know, if we're talking about like, well, Springer wants to play close to home in Connecticut and he wants to do a mid market, it's like, well, you know, piece two and two together. It's not that crazy to say that he could end up in New York. So
and Toronto's close enough. It's been great to- You're just going to make more money if you go to New York versus any contract you sign with the Blue Jays is going to be discounted significantly via the exchange rate right now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's true. It's just like, you know, if he wants to shoot up to home, you know, really quickly, like,
of course.
I think he's from, yeah, I think he's from the I forget what town in Connecticut specifically, but he's like, you know, probably 2 hours from the city or so. Yeah. So, I mean, that'll be really exciting. And then even if that doesn't happen, like the Lindor Carrasco trade was huge. We didn't give up very much. We got a, you know, generational shortstop, a potential MVP candidate at a position of need where we haven't had a great player since like the first go around of Jose Reyes. And like Lindor's probably better than Reyes ever was, honestly. Yeah. So yeah, it's and then Carrasco, you know, we got him as like what felt like a throw in. And he's,
yeah, I mean, we just got Lucchese today as a throw in.
Yeah, Lucchese's a solid like back end.
Where have these deals been for the last 2 decades where I feel like we were the team giving away like good players as throw ins? And now suddenly we're like the third team that just like comes out of the woodwork and like convinces somebody to like hand over like valuable talent.
Yeah, I don't feel conflicted at all. Like, I love that my team is doing this. I feel weird in that it's so representative of all of the issues in baseball right now in terms of like they're just being, and this has been the case for a long time, but they're really coming to the forefront now, where there are teams that just do not seem interested in competing at all. And like, I think there's a place for a rebuild and like a basketball style rebuild, even like where your fans know like, hey, this is not hurt for a couple years, but then there's going to be a chance for us to really like kind of shoot out like a rocket. And like, I don't think I don't think what happens in baseball happens in like the NBA or even the NFL, like what we saw with the Jaguars this year. Like, at least the fans in those leagues kind of see the vision and like can get behind it, even if it feels gross to some. But like in baseball, where it's just like, we're just in a flounder and get paid off luxury tax stuff forever and never really make a real run at it. Or maybe we luck into one, but then we don't, like the Marlins did twice and don't ever really care about keeping it up. Or like the Royals have like this last go around. It's not good when like there's like four teams in baseball arguably who are actually trying to make a go at like winning a title. It's like basically like the Dodgers, Padres, Astros, Mets, maybe the Yankees, even though they haven't been very aggressive. And like obviously that list will fluctuate here and there, but when you have like the Cubs selling off people for nothing, like what are we doing? So I'm appreciative of Steve Cohen coming in as like Mr. Moneybags, who doesn't really care about making like a return right away and wanting to just win because that's why he bought the team. Like, that's what owners should be doing when they have like stupid money to throw at sports franchises. Like, you should be trying to win. And it's just like, it just says something poor about like the state of baseball when there's no incentive. Like, the incentive in losing isn't to then get better. It's just to like cash out because there's an efficiency there. Or an inefficiency there. So yeah, I mean, I'm happy to be on that side of it, but I'd rather be the team with the owner who wants to win a lot and like a league of owners that want to win a lot, and he's just going to be more aggressive about it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I think baseball's headed for work stoppage. I know a lot of people think the same, just because it's clear something's not working. I mean, the fact that Springer sat on the market for this long as the, you know, arguably top free agent, is pretty ridiculous. I mean, the Mets have largely gotten better by way of trades, not via free agent additions. In general, this is just, it's become a weird league that's entirely based on a handful of big market franchises, and that's not changing unless you fundamentally alter how the league structures itself. And I think that's where we're headed. I just hope the Mets can get a couple titles out of whatever's happening right now. I'll take one, realistically.
I'll start with one. I'll be thrilled to start with one.
Yeah, I'll take just like a contending for more than 2 years at a time before existential dread takes over and the team is plunged back into the abyss. I think Cohen coming in had a chance to look like James Dolan, and I think he very quickly kind of level set with fans, you know, publicly and privately, that was not going to happen. He was not going to be like this kind of, you know, doofy meddling owner. He was a Mets fan himself. He surrounded himself with smart people to help make smart decisions. And he's quickly kind of, you know, exploited an inefficiency in the market when it comes to just like, you know, stupid teams like the Indians willing to like just panned over top tier talent for almost nothing. So good for you, Steve Cohen.
Thank you. Our
benevolent hedge fund ghoul.
He's ours and we love him.
For now.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, it's bizarre that that happened, and then a couple of days later, I think it was later again. I don't know what day or anything it is. I've been inside for a long time. My other team, my basketball team, traded for James Harden, a thing that I didn't actually think was going to happen after a while, and it did. So my thoughts on that are a little more complex, but it seems to have worked out so far.
I don't care. The Knicks have won as many games since that trade as you guys have.
Honestly, right after it happened, I was texting with some Knicks fans, friends, and the return for that one was a lot more significant than what the Mets did, but for Lindor. And at first, I was not thrilled with the return. I'm still not sure how I feel about it.
A lot of swaps, though, which isn't bad.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how long the Nets are good, which is like, the scary thing is like all the stars can walk like in a couple years. But if they don't, then it's fine. Like, but I was texting with some Knicks fans, friends who were like kind of teasing me about how much draft capital they gave up. And I'm like, yeah, I honestly don't know who's more excited right now. The Nets for getting yet another like top 10 NBA player or the Knicks for just like winning a couple games. Like the Knicks fans seem just as excited about things because they won like a few.
I mean, we beat the Celtics by 30. That counts for something.
No, they're definitely doing something right. Like I haven't watched enough of the games to like know if like Tibbs is like inevitably going to run people into the ground or if he's like performed a bit. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's like kind of what you sign up for. At least you're young and
Randall's playing like 40 and a half minutes a game.
Yeah, that doesn't seem ideal. But like, yeah, I mean, at least something seems to be changing there. So, and like, I've never hated the Knicks. They've just been kind of pitiable like the whole time I've rooted for them for the Nets. So, it's just like hard for me to get a lot of like hate going in that direction. So I'd like almost rather them be at least like. I mean, I find it very funny when they're like as bad as they've been, but. I don't know. I'd almost rather like get some kind of true rivalry going where like people actually care about the Nets for one reason or another. And then like Knicks fans aren't just like in a pit of despair all the time. Be nice to have like both franchises having something to look forward to.
Yeah. I mean, we've rarely been good at the same time, which I think is part of
the Nets are good occasionally and the Knicks aren't. So that's true.
Well, I mean, there was like a 15 year stretch where we were one of the best teams in basketball.
Yeah, I was like 8 years old.
I know. No, I'm saying not for you. I'm just saying in general, like for like the two franchises, like there's not a ton of you know caring about one another. In part because of the move. There's obviously a lot of fans who you know didn't carry over, or there's a lot of new fans that were just new to the fandom because of the move to Brooklyn. Like, and the fact that the two teams have rarely been good at the same time. That doesn't necessarily breed a ton of contempt. For one another in the long term. And you can talk about like, I mean, to relate it back to Syracuse, and we can pull this conversation all the way back in.
I bet to call this the Syracuse Pitt football series.
I was exactly what I was going to do.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Is that when you have, you know, two teams that are just never good at the same time, it is very, very difficult to generate real lasting animosity.
Maybe we could learn something about like from this, like for the greater world,
perhaps
like in sports, this is bad. But maybe we can find other ways to translate this lack of animosity to like the greater society. Maybe not.
I will bookmark the idea.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yes, Syracuse Pitt, the thing that happened twice in basketball recently where there is actual animosity and didn't go great.
Nope, that was rough. I wanted to do one more thing. We'll talk basketball in the second half. I want to do one more football thing before we get to that part of the episode, I guess. But yes, Syracuse did lose a game very badly to Pitt basketball. Like you and many others, I was not a fan of what happened. And I don't necessarily think that there's a easy solution for it, which is the worst part. But we'll get into that in the second half, which talks about beer and everything else. The last thing I wanted to get to before we get to halftime, Dan, is just a quick note about at least one staff change for the Syracuse football team. Terry Samuel comes in now to coach the wide receivers. He was at UNLV last year as the wide receiver and pass game coordinator. Before that, he spent 9 years as the Michigan State wide receivers coach. He's also coached under Babers at Arizona. He was on the team at Purdue when Babers was coaching on the Purdue staff. I like this hire. I think it's a smart one. Samuel has a lot of quality names. I counted earlier. I think it was 13 4 or 5 star players that he's gotten to commit.
I'm looking at that list now. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's a nice list, and it's not all wide receivers either. But obviously, we'd like the wide receivers in particular.
Tristan Jackson, one of them.
Yeah, Tristan Jackson was one of them. So you know what? I think this is again a good call. It's someone who is like tangentially related to Babers and his coaching tree, but not so much so that he can't kind of shake things up a bit. I want to see kind of how his pass game coordinator experience gets plugged in here. I think that the bigger question now is that since we assume he's not going to take on special teams duties, what happens with that role? Obviously inside receivers, which was part of Reno Ferry's duties, gets folded into what Samuel is doing. So Ferry seems unlikely to just be a tight ends coach. So does he absorb the running backs and that shuffles around like Lynch and Kavanaugh? Or do we see special teams get added to Ferry? Despite the fact that he doesn't really have much experience there. I'm curious what we see with the rest. I still wouldn't doubt it if we end up seeing somebody move to kind of off the field capacity with Jeff LePack moved up from his offensive analyst role.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to wait until the end of the like recruiting cycle right. Before we start to make any of these moves. Is that kind of usually that stuff happens with the early signing period now because so many guys lock in there. But I wonder if there's just like some hold out like situations that we're looking to settle before we like really announce the rest of the shuffling or any other hires we might have. But right now it doesn't seem like there's any like huge momentum to go out and get another person from the outside. Like this move was kind of a surprise. So yeah, it's tough to really know. Babers kind of works in silence more than some other coaches.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely not someone like Babers has like, I mean, Pete Thamel is definitely like somebody that's keyed into what's going on with the Babers staff and typically has the scoops. He didn't on this one. Nate Mink did over at Syracuse.com. But yeah, usually like that's really the only person you ever hear like leak anything out. Babers is like very, very, very like tight-lipped about a lot of things, but in particular this. I know that was a big theme of his contract negotiations too. I think it was one of the, has this ever been confirmed that like, wasn't this one of the main reasons why like Missouri never happened for Babers was because it was like leaked that he was in conversation. It was one or the other that like there was like,
I remember something about this, but I don't remember like exactly what went down.
Yeah. Like I'm not going to commit to it as like a fact. But I'm just like recalling something along those lines that like a potential job pretty much like fell through because they couldn't like keep it under wraps long enough to sign a contract. In any case, I like Samuel. I don't think this is the end of the changes this offseason, but like you said, I think we're probably waiting till the end of National Signing Day and everything now. SU doesn't seem like they're going to be super active on National Signing Day this year. They only have a handful of scholarships left. There's only one guy left who hasn't signed. And then it seems like there's a couple of random offers like JUCO guys for 2021. But most of the focus seems to now just be on, getting some impact transfers at a couple key positions. And realistically, like I think that's where SU could use the most help. Obviously, we have a lot of young talent on this football roster. What we don't have is a lot of experienced talent. And so I wouldn't mind adding a couple of grad transfers or like some upperclassmen who can inject some immediate help at some key spots. Cornerback being one of those, offensive line being another. I'd entertain defensive line, but we just don't know yet who's back. I assume that's going to happen soon, though, just because it is getting kind of late in the process for guys to declare for the draft, for guys to declare if they're back. So I'm assuming by the end of this week or so, we start hearing more about like the definitive roster for next year.
Yeah, I we talked about it like a couple weeks ago, but I do miss kind of bigger rush of information that would come in February with signing day. And now it just kind of gets, you know, it's earlier, but also just like recruiting is less dramatic, I think, than it was. But yeah, it's I don't know. I think people probably wish there was a little more excitement in terms of like changes and shakeups and stuff. But it does seem like we're just kind of betting on some small incremental things. Hopefully, you know, there's some JUCO guys that we're not super aware of, because that JUCO stuff can kind of pop up out of nowhere because there's like a lot less attention paid to it compared to like the top end high school recruiting. But yeah, it's, you know, hopefully we get some impact guys, because just relying on interesting freshmen to turn into like really solid sophomores, like that can be, you know, that can be good at times, but you still want to have some veterans, and you can't rely on like everyone to take this big step forward, especially when you're coming off a one-win season.
Yeah, I agree there. And like, it's one thing if you're, you know, a top 25-ish program year in and year out, and you're doing that, and it's all blue chip guys. It's another if you're relying on being able to coach up a ton of, you know, three-star guys to suddenly be ACC caliber starters across the board. So yeah, I would very much like to see some veteran talent. But Dan, why don't we talk a little bit about beer before we jump into more hoops conversation?
I haven't had too much recent stuff, but I'm trying to remember what I didn't get to last time I was on. The last couple check-ins I had on Untapped, which I think were probably right after we recorded, I had some Psychokinesis from Grimm and some Spaghetti Parm Space Station from Thin Man, which were both really good. And I currently have a fridge full of single cut that I'm going to hopefully get to here in the coming days. So I should have a lot of single cut to discuss next week.
Very nice. Not too much different for me. Finished up that Beechwood 13, the Pilsner that I had mentioned in the last episode. Had some Dry River Arantia as a kind of dry hop sour, pretty light, around 5%, but really, really good. And then from Modern Times, I have a membership with them this year. So got a few different crowlers that were on. My buddy had gone to pick up some stuff. Got a Black House Vanilla Latte edition, their coffee stout. It was really good. And then Magic Windows, a just West Coast IPA from them. That was like a little bit maltier. Still like nice, herbal, crisp. Overall, like, good beer. Definitely definitely a repeat if they end up hopefully canning it at some point. Like I said, this one was just a crowler. So yeah, I have plenty of Modern Times stuff actually in the fridge that I'll probably be talking about next week, along with some an array of sours that I need to start getting through, because the beer fridge is pretty much full at this point.
Very nice.
Yeah. The problem is I'm the only one that drinks, and my wife doesn't drink sours. So if I'm not in a sour mood, then the fridge pretty much stays full from week to week.
Yeah. And they're like something that like, I really enjoy sours, but like, you know, I usually need to be in a mood for them, and then I only want like one or two before I switch over to something else. So I can definitely see them stacking up.
Yeah. And there's definitely been some, especially now that I'm not just like buying a bottle while I'm out. It's more like getting a shipment of bottles. And like several, that's when everything starts stacking up. And
yeah,
but we'll get to it. And certainly not the worst problem in the world to have.
these important problems of our times.
Agreed. All right, Dan. speaking of bottles and what's needed.
Speaking of problems.
I guess we're talking about Syracuse men's basketball. What happened on Saturday was a complete and utter disaster. 64 points was one shy of the SU record for most points allowed in the second half. They lost 96-76 at Pitt. This was giving me like not even flashbacks to the Jamie Dixon era. This was just flashbacks to like the 06-07, like 07-08 seasons, where like just stretches were completely unwatchable. Like this was rough, like by any definition. And I don't really know what the solution. I mean, and two, like, we'll get into this. One of the most aggravating parts about this game in particular was that despite the blowout, despite the fact that SU got run off the floor over the last like 10, 15 minutes of this game, you had three different guys play at least 38 minutes.
Yeah, it's the I don't know. It's steading very old for me. Like I don't know how we keep on doing this where we run out these super shallow teams that aren't like winning ball games and don't say like, if we're going to lose a game like this where we're just getting run off the court in the second half, like
empty the bench,
throw some other guys out there and see, because it wasn't going to get worse.
Jesse Edwards played 1 minute.
Yeah. You have Edwards. I don't know what's happening.
Woody Newton played two.
Like, yeah.
What are we doing?
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, even Tenari kind of fell out of the rotation there in the second half. And I know he hasn't played well behind Madress. He's like, Jar's been bad, but Tenari's not been like better. It's like, okay, well, like, so we're just going to throw Gerard back out there and that's just going to be what it is. Like, at least like give them, let one of them try to do something different. It's just very frustrating.
Like, I'd rather Richmond. Did you look at like if you look at the stats in this game, like Gerard, 22 minutes, 2 points, one steal, one turnover, one assist, two fouls. Like Kadari in 18 minutes, better defender by a mile, actually hit a field goal. Great. Like he's got 3 rebounds, 4 assists, 0 turnovers. Like what are we doing?
And if it was the opposite, if it was like Kadari was playing the bulk of the minutes and he was just like really bad, and then we just refused to see if Gerard could like go and hit some threes, I'd also be annoyed. So like, right. It's just, you don't need to, it's gotten worse. And I think part of it's that like our benches have been less impressive in recent years than like, you know, obviously the vaulted days where we had like guys who could easily be starters on the bench. But if it's going to be a problem, at least like see what you have, try to develop some people. It just seems like our development's hit such a snag in the last couple of years. I don't know if it's like the lack of like a guy like Hopkins there but it just seems like we're so desperate to try to eke out these wins with our starting five. And if they don't have it, it's just like completely doomed. Yeah. It's very frustrating. And I think like there's, you know, myriad issues. I think with this team, like we clearly don't have like that go-to guy. Like even, you know, the Tyus Battle teams and last year's team led by Elijah weren't great, but we knew who was going to get the ball. We knew who could like get a bucket. This year, we really don't have that guy. I think there are days where Griffin looks like it, but like he's a ghost sometimes. Quincy, I think, could be that guy, but he's like, you know, I appreciate his efficiency, but he clearly doesn't quite think he is yet. And like, maybe he's not, but at least like he seems to have a very good idea of what he's doing whenever he has the ball. And then if Buddy and Joe, they're the only ones who were like super green light to shoot the ball. And if they're cold, we're pretty much shot.
Yeah, they were in this game, they were combined 4 of 16. All four were Buddy. They were combined 0 for 11 from three. SU was 3 for 23 from long range. Two of those were Griffin. One of those was Guerrier. Guerrier's turned into, I mean, we talked about development. And while I do agree with you, one place where development has really worked out somehow is with Guerrier, somebody who took a, I think, you know, we talked about this before the season started. Like we said, this would be great if Guerrier could take a mild leap. And instead, Guerrier could, I think I got this right. I think Guerrier could be the first player. He's getting close to being the first player at SU to average a double-double since Melo.
Did Rack, the senior, or Rich Jackson, maybe?
Maybe. And they're I could the only be wrong. I can think of. Yeah, I was like looking through Orange Hoops, shout out to Ray, to see if I could like figure this out. But even like those, like even like AO, like AO is considered like a force inside.
He didn't play enough, like, I don't think, because we had so many guys.
Yeah, he was 10 and a half and 5.1 rebounds. No, you're right. Rick had 13 and 10.
His last year, I thought Rick was probably up there.
Yeah, so then Rack was 17 and a half and 9.1.
Okay. Yeah, it's Gary has been a race success story. It's just like he's not a guy where when you need a bucket, you're going to be like, all right, we're going to give Quincy the ball and let him do it to work. And maybe that's part of that's just another, you know, function of the offense needing some overhaul, because it shouldn't just be up to like an isolation wing getting a bucket. And there should be more ways for us to manufacture Gary getting the ball in an advantageous position. But it is frustrating on top of that to like have this player have this such as this breakout season, one that he may be able to play himself into an NBA spot after this year. Like I don't think it'd be a surprise of anyone if he jumps now, or, you know, maybe stays another year, but he's probably getting close to where you could say like he's gonna get drafted for sure and not take advantage of it. And yeah, it's just overall very, very difficult to deal with. And like I don't really blame the players. Like, obviously, you guys are going to have cold nights, but it shouldn't just be the case where if, like, your two shooters are cold, then it's going to be a struggle to get anything going. especially when we have like a number of players who look interesting, like William Newton earlier in the year, like that Rutgers game looked like a really interesting young player. Braswell has had moments these last couple games, but you know, if they get pulled after one mistake and have no reassurance that they're ever going to be able to get back into that game, like it's going to be really hard to let them play through stuff. And like at this point in the season, like we're just not good enough to not let those players try to find some stuff in live game action. Like I don't, obviously none of us see practice, but it's from our perspective, I think it's just very tough to watch the same lineup go out and it's like, all right, well, they're either going to have it or they're not. And if they don't have it, it could get very ugly very quick.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, have it is there's several different dimensions to that too. It's one, it's the guards and their ability to shoot. And like realistically, like you have two streaky shooters who are like not good defenders, to put it mildly, like that becomes a problem. I think Gerard being the streakier, I think Buddy knows how to make himself useful in the mid range, even though he doesn't like drive the lane a ton, he does know how to hit mid range shots. So he finds a way, even if it's still not like an efficient way. And I think the two of them being so entrenched is one of the bigger problems. But then you look at like some other, like even a guy like Dolezal, who like we love, obviously. 14 points, great. But you know, two boards and like realistically, like the guy playing the five, the majority of the time can't just have two boards. Like that's a recipe for disaster. And if you look back at the box scores, in a lot of these games, the games that we lose are the games that, you know, Marek kind of disappears on the boards. And a lot of it's positioning, not just him, but in general, the team, like you see, there's at least a couple of guys cheating back already because this team isn't the best defensively. Guys are cheating back. There's a lot of clustering in terms of spacing. It's not great. And you see it on defense too. Like the zone is not as crisp as it could be and should be. And that's why it's so easy for teams to be able to haul in offensive rebounds against us. But you know, this was another one of these games that kind of turned into like 2.5 players on offense, realistically, where it was Griffin obviously having a dominant 28 points. And then, you know, Guerrier, you know, going 8 for 19 for 18. But like from an efficiency standpoint, I just feel like the shots we're taking have been bad. We've been chucking more often, like 3 for 23, like those threes weren't all good. And if you look at like the shot charts, we're only good at like, in like two specific areas of the floor, and then everywhere else we're like piss poor. And it just seems like we're seeing more and more chucking from the areas where we're piss poor. And I think that between that, you know, all these like random pull-ups, like 2 feet inside the 3-point line, like this team is very, very good at the rim. You know, they're hitting almost 79% of their shots at the rim. Obviously it depends on who you're going up against, and the opposing center standpoint, but like work it inside. The more you work it inside, the more there's going to be, you know, uncontested threes on the outside. And you really need to, like, this team is trying to work outside to create space inside, like the Warriors once did. And realistically, that's not the team they have. They have a team that can create inside, and that's going to open up space outside. So work on that, the more traditional, you know, approach that a team with a couple 3-point shooters would use towards having, you know, them out there with big men driving the lane, especially Dolezal. And you and I have talked about this, like, Dolezal is a fantastic adept passer, and frequently he's sitting around on the wing, you know, getting the ball to poorly spaced offense. Like drive him inside and have him kick out if he's not going to finish at the rim. That's where he's most effective, and that's where he's going to be able to create opportunities for this team.
Yeah, and we've seen games where Marek has had, you know, a good chunk of assists and is like kind of managing offense. And it seems like we do go away from that really quickly too. Like there are some games where it seems to be a focal point, others where it's just like not part of the offense at all. And obviously he doesn't need to rebound better, but I feel bad for Marek because I feel like he's been playing out of position for almost his entire career here. Like he should not be playing center outside of like maybe a couple occasions playing small ball. And obviously with the Sidibe injury, which has been way bigger than I ever anticipated it being, not like as an offense Barama, but like, I thought he was like a nice center, but I'm like, all right, you know, we could probably get by playing Marek there. I think Barama's been a way more important, it's been revealed to be a way more important player in his absence than I think we probably suggested. But it's not helpful again that we're just completely unwilling to give the young centers any kind of room. Obviously Anselm's been like unavailable, but you know, we have a bunch of young centers. You'd think people did like 5 minutes, 10 minutes here and there from them. But yeah, it just all goes back to like I just don't know what the If a game's going to look like the Pitt game, and like obviously the UNC game was pretty close, and like if we had won that game, maybe we're having a much different conversation today. But if you're going to have a game go as completely haywire as Pitt did in the second half, like I just don't see the reason, like the reason why you can't at least try something and give some guys a chance to like prove themselves or just to like try to find some spark somewhere. And we just are so unwilling to do that most of the time. It's very, very annoying to watch, because like watching the same five guys just get run out of the gym is just, no one's enjoying that. No one's getting anything of value from that, I don't think.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
No, and realistically, it's a bad message to send to recruits to around development, to kind of circle back to your earlier point, is that if we're not going to show an ability to get young players run, especially in blowouts where it's absolutely like an easy win to give you guys some rest, but more importantly, give the young guys some minutes on the floor in conference competition. I don't necessarily get it. But didn't just want to rehash the past here. Didn't want to talk about what we have up against SU on Tuesday. They're facing a Miami team that just pulled an upset against Louisville. That's a little disconcerting. Miami's not like a great team this year, 6-6, 2-5 in the ACC. So certainly not like world beaters by any means, but they do seem to have the personnel to really exploit us the same way that Pitt did the other day, you know, against Louisville. Like Isaiah Wong had 30 points, was 12-20 from the floor, 7 boards. Like this is a team that can rebound, does rebound, finds ways on the offensive glass, and that could potentially like kill us. They can also score from a variety of places and like 4 different guys who really got involved in the offense against Louisville, but they have others that they can call upon as well. Like, to me, this is definitely a problem area that needs to be addressed inside. But more importantly, like, without finding, like, this team has to find a way, for Syracuse's standpoint, needs to find a way to score points when threes don't fall. And they did that against Buffalo. And every game since then has just been, a complete zoo. So I don't know if it's just the additional time off, the fact that practices have been cut so much this year, but it does seem like we're now in this, like, you know, if the threes don't fall, we're toast situation. And I don't think this team has to do that. I think they're just choosing to, at least from like my point of view.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there needs to be some kind of like, if the three ball isn't falling, we just like go ISO and kind of fall apart. Like there has to be some kind of deliberate attempt to find something else, whether it's going kind of Marek at the center out, like we see teams attack us when we're in the zone, trying to find open shooters that way, or you know, just doing something else that gets the ball to the perimeter, where, like you said, we are, I think, one of the best teams in college basketball at the rim, which you would never know because it's not like it's a huge thing for us at this point. So I don't know what to feel about Miami. Like, they've been very, very streaky this year. Obviously, the Louisville win is disconcerting, but they're 6-6. Like, they lost three straight earlier in the year, although they were all close games to Vatek, Clemson, UNC. They lost to Pitt by a similar margin to us. They lost to Florida Gulf Coast, which is not the Florida Gulf Coast team from 2013. They got blown up by BC right before Louisville. So they are definitely not a complete, like, package right now, but you know, I think any of these teams at the in like bottom half of the ACC can kind of find themselves here on a night-to-night basis. And then, like you said, I don't know how much to blame this on our like repeated pauses. Like, I don't think it's helped by any means, but and also like the injuries haven't helped. But I think you just have to find something, because like every team is dealing with some level of this at this point. So it's not like the excuse is going to you know, have other teams just being like, oh yeah, Syracuse had a really hard time with things. Like, it's just, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know that's going to factor in much when it comes to like tournament time or whatever.
Yeah, I agree there. And at this point too, like, you look at the around the ACC, there's just not a ton of real like big wins for you to pick up. And there's also like not a lot of like signature wins to get outside of those. So realistically, like if you can't knock off, you know, Vatek, Virginia, Clemson, or maybe Louisville, like Duke and North Carolina are bubble teams this year. Like, NC State's a bubble team this year. Like we're a bubble team at best. Like there's not this like there's not this glut of wins just like waiting out there for us to like make the tournament. Like we're pretty much in a situation now. Like if we can't beat Miami, you've got Vatek, Virginia, NC State, Louisville, Clemson, NC State. Before your next like quote unquote like winnable game against BC, like this thing could crater very, very quickly if SU can't get it done on Tuesday night.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not looking forward to it. I do think like it's very easy to like get super down based on the Pitt loss, and like right before that we beat Georgetown, which I know is not a super inspiring win considering what Georgetown is. But then also like the UNC game was a very winnable game. The last Pitt game was very winnable. So obviously like. We've played some games closer. This was like the one really like horrible loss so far this year. Right. So you get a couple wins if you upset Vatek or you upset UVA. I think we can get like win some people back over. But after how we played in this Pitt, like obviously we've had bad losses like that here and there. Like I feel like there's always one every year basically where we just show up and look like we have no idea what we're doing.
And we usually win five straight.
Yeah, and then we do something and we get back in it and, you know, either we make the tournament or don't, but at least we have, like, a moment where things look good. So, obviously, I'm not, you know, that could certainly be the case here. We could rebound really quick, but, yeah, I totally get why people are so demoralized. And you know, Behan Tubis, he wasn't really shy about it with the, like, worst defense quote. So, yeah, hopefully next week we'll be like, oh, that was, you know, this feels very foreign to us after, you know, we have two games here. Miami and Vatek before we speak next.
Yeah, and I mean, technically, we're going to be speaking during the Virginia game.
Yeah.
The last time we did that, I feel like things went poorly.
I don't remember what it was, but...
I think it was the game that they just, like, blew us out of the gym in the second half.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That sounds right.
Can't wait.
All right, Dan. Who do you think is going to win this game in Syracuse, Miami?
I'll be optimistic. I'll say Syracuse figures it out. I think it'll be a really close one. I'm going to and I'm basing this just on like, I think we need some good vibes here. I'm going to go Syracuse. I'll go 73-69.
All right. I do not have faith in this one. I think they might be able to knock off Vatek, but I'm going Miami 77, Syracuse 71. I think SU needs like one more poor effort to like get it together, unfortunately.
All right. Well, hopefully like we just need to get one this week. I mean, we just need a lot of things. But if we lose out and then we're playing UVA this time next week, it's not going to be too fun.
No, I think realistically, if the next two are losses, and you're staring down a seemingly resurgent UVA team. I'm not too encouraged, unfortunately.
No.
Well, that was a great note to end on.
It's all uplifting here.
Dan, anything else before we go?
No, hopefully we're wrong. Hopefully we next week we're on a very you know, punchy, uppity, more happy note. But you know, we can only be who we are.
Fair. I don't think it's worth changing at this point. We're many years into this show. We're closing in on this will be the end of, well, we're closing in on the end of 8 years or the end of seven. I think it's the end of 8.
I never remember exactly when it started. It also just kind of started like.
It started in 2013.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So yeah, we've been doing this for 8 years somehow.
Always amazing.
The longest running, the longest consistently running Syracuse podcast on the internet.
That's just a fact.
Yeah, that is a fact. You actually can't argue that. And radio shows don't count.
Yes,
and actually, even Brent took some time off.
We are the constant,
the only constant in your Syracuse audio life.
We are the Daniel Faraday of the Syracuse the Syracuse podcast world.
Jesus. All right. Well, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you everybody for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Great review, subscribe on iTunes, Megaphone, Spotify. Tune in, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, and go Orange.
Orange.